And we were always very careful when we wrote this show not to take sides, not to comment. We wanted the audience to make up its own mind. And the result was, curiously, we thought everybody would hate the program and government. The civil servants loved it because it showed that they were so brilliant around the country. The politicians loved it because it showed that the civil service was an obstacle. And liberals liked it because they thought it had a vaguely liberal sort of feel. And so the strange result was that people across the political spectrum and the civil service really liked the show because in some ways it reflected what all of them thought.
And now, The Good Fight with Yascha Monk.
Hi, my name is William Derazowicz. I'm an author, essayist, critic. My most recent piece for Persuasion is called How Pseudo-Intellectualism Ruined Journalism. And the basic idea is that as journalists' social position has changed, their relationship to ideas has changed. So journalism used to be a working class profession. And when you grow up working class, you tend to develop a distanced and skeptical relationship to ideas, to experts, to theories. You see them as maybe misrepresenting reality, not close enough to the ground. And that's what I encountered at the Columbia Journalism School when I went there in the 80s. I think that has problems, but I'm even more concerned about what's happened since. Because journalism, especially prestige journalism, places like the New York Times, the Washington Post, NPR, God help us, has become not just a college-educated profession, but an elite college-educated profession. And when you grow up upper middle class in what we now call the professional managerial class, you develop a relationship to ideas that bespeaks the values of the class of experts. And you tend to approach reality through the filter of theoretical knowledge. And then you go to your elite college and, you know, you learn critical theory and you learn all the buzzwords and all the jargon. You're not being taught to think so much as to let those abstractions do your thinking for you. And then you go out and you become a prestige journalist and you see the world through the filter of the theoretical concepts that you've acquired. You become a pseudo-intellectual, which means that you may think you're thinking, but you're really just repeating. So I invite you to read the piece to see what more I say about this and to make up your own mind. Thank you.
William Derazowicz's article, How Pseudo-Intellectualism Ruined Journalism, was published by Persuasion. To learn more about the community we're building at Persuasion and to get similar articles directly into your inbox, head to www.persuasion.community.
My guest today is Jonathan Lynn. Jonathan is a very accomplished actor, writer, and director. He has directed, among others, the movies My Cousin Vinny and The Whole Nine Yards. But I'm afraid to say for an American audience that I rather focused on a show that is very meaningful to me, which is, yes, Minister and, yes, Prime Minister. By far and away, the best political sitcom that has ever been made in my book, and a show that, as I explain in my conversation with Jonathan, was very formative to me when I was an undergraduate in the United Kingdom. It helped teach me English, and it helped me understand the United Kingdom, and it helped me understand politics as a whole. So to give those of you listeners who don't know, yes, Minister, a little bit more of a sense of what we actually are talking about in the podcast this week, I want to present to you a clip from the show. In the clip you're about to hear, Sir Humphrey, the civil servant, the permanent secretary of the Ministry of Administrative Affairs, is explaining to Jim Hacker, the Minister of Administrative Affairs, what he regards the proper purpose of government, which is not, Sir Humphrey says, to be moral.
Government isn't about morality.
Really? What is it about then?
Stability. Keeping things going. Preventing anarchy. Stopping society falling to bits. Still being here tomorrow.
What for? What is the ultimate purpose of government, if it isn't for doing good?
Minister, government isn't about good and evil. It's only about order or chaos.
And it's in order for Italian terrorists to get British bombs. And you don't care?
It's not my job to care. That's what politicians are for. My job is to carry out government policy.
Even if you think it's wrong?
Well, almost all government policy is wrong, but... frightfully well carried out.
Here's another even more famous clip from the show. It comes from the 1980s and describes the way that Jim Hacker, the politician at the time, regarded the landscape of British newspapers. But as those of you who have a little bit of a sense of the UK press landscape today will recognize, it still bears a certain relevance to today. You'll also hear the voice at the beginning of Sir Humphrey, the brilliant civil servant, and at the end of Bernard Woolley, the principal private secretary of a minister, a civil servant who has a tendency to be rather less artful in his way of expressing himself.
The only way to understand the press is to remember that they pander to their readers' prejudices.
Don't tell me about the press. I know exactly who reads the papers. The Daily Mirror is read by people who think they run the country. The Guardian is read by people who think they ought to run the country. The Times is read by the people who actually do run the country. The Daily Mail is read by the wives of the people who run the country. The Financial Times is read by people who own the country. The Morning Star is read by people who think the country ought to be run by another country. And the Daily Telegraph is read by people who think it is.
I'm Prime Minister, what about the people who read The Sun?
The Sun readers don't care who runs the country as long as she's got big tits.
Jonathan Lynn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So it's a particular pleasure for me to have you on the podcast because I admire much of your work and because you're the creator of a show that probably did more than any other television show to teach me English and certainly more than any other television show to help me understand the United Kingdom. Now, my audience is mostly American. It's very international, but it's mostly American with people from all over Europe and Latin America and Asia and some people in Africa. So for those who may not know Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister in particular, tell us a little bit about what the show is and how it came to have really a remarkable influence on British culture and British politics.
That's such a big question. I can tell you what the show is. It's a situation comedy, 39 half-hour episodes. Well, actually 38 episodes, one of which lasts an hour. And it's about the way the British government worked in those days, and largely speaking, still does. It takes place in the office of a cabinet minister, and he's one of the three principal parts. And he has a permanent secretary who's head of the civil service, called Sir Humphrey. And there is a private secretary. The minister has a private secretary who truly is the servant of two masters because he owes his career to Sir Humphrey, the senior civil servant, but he has to please the minister who he's working for at this time. And they are usually in opposition with each other. What the show is about, I'm not making this sound very funny, am I? What the show is about is how the British government works. It's not party political. What we wrote about could apply to any government we've had in Britain for the last 60, 70 years, I don't know. It could apply to a Labour government, it could apply to a Tory government. In fact, the first series was written when there was a Labour government in power, although it never got on the air until Mrs. Thatcher came to power. You asked me about its influence. Well, I can't explain that. We were puzzled when the BBC refused to put the programme out prior to the election when Mrs. Thatcher actually got elected because they seemed to think it could have some effect on the way the public voted, and the BBC always has to be impartial. We were surprised by that. We expected it to last for 6 episodes on BBC Two, which is a sort of smaller channel in those days, and we thought that would be a lot of fun. And that would be that. And to our surprise, it seemed to take over the political world. And it got to a stage where on whatever night it was being broadcast, the House of Commons chamber would empty because everyone was in the bars watching the show. Mrs. Thatcher announced that it was her favourite programme. Tapes were not available in those days. And At the end of the first series, there was a request from the Queen to see the show, to see the tapes. And it seems to have become a sort of a fixture on the British landscape. And when people talk about civil servants now, they call them Sir Humphrey. This is bewildering to me, and I think it was to Tony, who is no longer with us. But does that answer your question in the most general terms?
It does very much. I mean, by the time that I went to England for university in the early 2000s, you know, his prime minister was not only a key way to view and understand British politics, it had also become part of a sort of firmament of the great British comedy shows from 40 Towers to Blackadder and then Yes Minister. Part of the brilliance of it is that it's a very, very simple show. I mean, it really is, for the most part, there's, of course, different characters who come in for each episode, and there's some shoots outside of the office of Jim Hacker, the Minister for Administrative Affairs, or later the Prime Minister. But by and large, it is a combination of two or three of these three characters sitting in an office and speaking with each other.
That's right. And we were surprised. We were surprised by its success and by its continued success, because it doesn't have any of the ingredients which are normally associated with a successful television series. It's three elderly, well, middle-aged to elderly men talking. They're talking about government. There is no action. There are no fights. There's no explosions. There's hardly any women. We didn't expect, and we still don't understand, why that has remained so popular.
As you created this show, you must have thought of this as a challenge, right? Oh my God, we're only going to have this one interior, basically. We're always going to have the same three people talk to each other. A lot of the point of the show, and we're going to get to its more political aspects in a moment, is that the attempts of the minister, who is, you know, in certain ways more likable, but also a lot less brilliant than the civil servant, to change something, to do something, to remedy some obvious shortcoming of a government, by and large, those fail. So it's not just that there's only three people talking, two civil servants and a sort of middling politician. It's that whatever the minister tries to do in the end, 9 times out of 10, doesn't come to fruition. So nothing happens in a double way. I mean, Seinfeld famously is a show about nothing. You could say, but Yes Minister is truly the show about nothing. So how did you think about animating the show, dramatizing it in such a way that it would nevertheless remain entertaining? And it seems to me that you trusted a lot in the power of words, in the power of puns, in the power of language, because it really, in a sense, is a radio play.
I don't know how to answer that. All plays are really radio plays. If you go to the theatre, you could say the play you're watching is really a radio play, because all theatre is about language. There are some visual aspects. I'm not talking about the musical theatre, but essentially, drama is about language in most cases. It's not true to say that the minister hardly ever got what he wanted. It was about half and half, actually. People always assumed that Jim Hacker didn't get what he wanted, but he usually found a way to compromise with Sir Humphrey, and they usually made some kind of a deal with each other. Occasionally, Jim won hands down. Occasionally, Humphrey did. Apart from that, I don't know how to answer the question, except what was interesting to people was that they didn't really know what happened in government. They knew what happened in politics, and they thought politics was government, and they voted every few years, and they read the newspapers. But what they never saw was what happens behind the scenes. And behind the scenes, you have a bunch of very high-powered, very intelligent civil servants who are recruited straight from, in those days, Oxford or Cambridge, but now from all the universities, who essentially ran the country. They knew what to do. They were experts. They joined a department, whether it was the Foreign Office or the Home Office or whatever, and they were there for most of their career. They'd seen everything. They'd done everything. They knew how things were done. And they were full-time. Now, a cabinet minister, on the other hand, is a complete amateur. He's appointed by the prime minister, usually to a department about which he or she knows nothing. They're reshuffled every year or two, in the case of the recent Tory government, every month or two, for party political reasons. Now, if you can imagine being made head of a huge corporation, the Department of Administrative Affairs probably had 200,000 to 300,000 people working for it across the country. If you can imagine being made head of that, the titular head of it, knowing nothing about it, you would be utterly dependent on the civil servants. And the civil servants know that. And the civil servants don't really want ministerial interference because they regard themselves as custodians of what's right and wrong about government and experts. The politician, the minister, is someone who comes and goes, and in any case is only there for maybe a third of his time because he has to be in the Commons many days, the House of Commons, or if he's a member of the Lords, the House of Lords, and he has to be go off on various visits. He has to go to his constituency every weekend, and he has all kinds of public relations jobs to do. So the result is every government department is essentially run by the civil servants. In British political history, there have been a few ministers who were genuinely in charge of their department. They were intellectually up to the civil servants and knew enough about it. There was Dennis Healey when he was Minister of Defence. There was Roy Jenkins when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer. That's the Treasury Minister. There have been a few. But mostly, these ministers can't cope, and by the time they know anything about their department, they're moved on to another job by the Prime Minister in some reshuffle. So what you've got is politicians who regard civil servants as unelected, elitist, self-appointed people who run the government and get in their way. And the civil servants regard politicians as people who will do anything for short-term electoral advantage to win votes and can't be trusted with the nation's destiny. So you've got a huge conflict there. In comedic terms, it's an old formula. P.G. Woodhouse's Jeeves and Bertie Wooster is an example of, you know, of the servant who is more able than the master.
That's very nice. I hadn't thought of Sir Humphrey as Jeeves and Jim Hacker as Worcester. It makes a lot of sense, actually. And of course, there is the ongoing theme throughout the show of Sir Humphrey slightly looking down at Jim Hacker in particular, but it's sort of all elected politicians, right? I mean, Humphrey, I believe, went to Balliol College, Oxford, and of course, took a first, whereas you know, Jim Hacker only went to the LSE, which you know, Sir Humphrey seems to think of as a great embarrassment. If there is a kind of political thesis of the show, it is, in a sense, the hollowness of democracy, isn't it? I mean, there is a suggestion, and I think what you said just now goes in the same direction, that we think that we vote for these politicians and they're elected to government and they go to parliament, and they're going to change the laws and change the way the country is run in accordance with the will of the electorate. But what actually happens in the show, and I guess you're saying, but actually Jim Hacker does sometimes get his way, so perhaps you would qualify that, is that it is the civil service that really runs the show, that really makes the decision, that really knows how things are done, and is incredibly capable of frustrating the political will of a minister. So I guess the first question I would ask is, do you think that's right? Do you think there is a hollowness to British democracy because of the strength of the civil service and perhaps to democratic systems in other countries as well? And how should we feel about that? Because I think the show is a little bit ambivalent in what we might think about that. Margaret Thatcher, I think, saw it as a great indictment of the civil service, as sort of a great reason why that system needs tremendous reform. But a lot of the people who watch the show end up sort of identifying with Sir Humphrey. And I had more than a few contemporaries in university who decided that they wanted to join the fast track of the civil service, as it was then, because they actually tremendously admired Sir Humphrey and thought, I kind of want to be him. So is it true that the civil service has such outsized power over politics? And how should we feel about that? Is that a scary fact? And a fact that should make us angry, or in certain ways a comforting fact as well?
We weren't trying to make anybody angry. We were just showing what is, well, what was, and what largely still is. because most people didn't know what civil servants did at all. They thought of them as kind of dull people with bowler hats who sat around drinking tea. And the only civil servants they came across were very low-level people at the Labour Exchange or in other government departments, the Department of Motor Vehicles. But they didn't ever come across the people who run the country, which is 3,000 civil servants in Whitehall. Does it make democracy hollow? Yes. Democracy is hollow, but so is autocracy for other reasons. What it does is it shows that if a minister particularly wants a special policy to get through and perseveres, the minister can do that. But out of the vast array of governmental decisions that have to be made day in and day out, I would say that the civil service gets its way on about 90% of them, and the minister gets his way on about 10% of them, or her way on about 10% of them. But they may be very important matters indeed. They may be what the minister really wants to achieve. So it does bring democracy into question in a way, except that sometimes Jim is right to fight for what he wants, and sometimes Sir Humphrey is wrong to resist it. Sometimes Jim gets what he wants, and sometimes he doesn't. We just watch and say, this is what it is. This is what's happening. This is why. It's also one of the reasons why politicians like the show is because it gave them an alibi. Because they could say to themselves, they could say to the public for the first time, well, we didn't get this done, which we promised, but the system stopped us.
It's because all of the Sir Humphreys, who are permanent secretaries of all these departments, were stopping us from being able to do what we want.
Exactly. And to which the civil service would reply, well, what you wanted was really a bad idea. And, you know, there was a lot, we once used a famous old line when Sir Humphrey said, Minister, if you must do this damn silly thing, don't do it in such a damn silly way. So even when the civil service were opposing Jim, they were sort of helping him. They were helping him to make it something that could function, could work. I don't think it means that democracy is hollow. I think it just means that you can't have unlimited faith in politicians or in the system. It's, you know, that old Latin tag, who guards the guards? Who guards the civil service? Well, they have to guard themselves because most politicians are not capable of doing so.
I am struck by the way in which the show illustrates political processes. You know, if Max Weber says that politics is the hard boring of hard boards, that it takes this tremendous will and power and energy to change things in the direction you want, I think that, yes, Minister is the best illustration I've ever come across in fiction or nonfiction, in popular culture or in academic writing, to illustrate that. And I've always dreamt of teaching a lecture course that's an introduction to politics, in which the beginning of each lecture would be a clip of Yes, Minister or Yes, Prime Minister. And it would be very easy to do. I'm sure some people have done it.
Please feel free.
Thank you. But I want to dig down into some of the ways in which perhaps Britain has changed and other democracies have changed and see sort of how you feel about those. So one of them is that strikes me in this show that everybody, including the elected politician, for particularly the civil servants, have this incredibly strong sense of values and norms that are larger than themselves. Now, sometimes they're rather silly norms. A lot of them, you know, certainly Sir Humphrey is somebody who we would think of today as in various ways exclusionary and bigoted. He's certainly very rigid in many ways. He has an idea of how things are done because of tradition and longstanding norms that he's unwilling to be flexible on. But that they also, in a sense, give a political system a mooring, right? They give him a sense of values that he's certainly a man who's capable of selfishness. He's not a great altruist, But there are guardrails to how he acts that are given to him by generations of tradition and the way in which he has been raised to conceive of his job and his role. And it seems to me that this is something that is largely absent from public life today, that the extent to which people have this sense of being bound by intergenerational longstanding norms and procedures has gone. And today, you know, one of the catchphrases of Sir Humphrey that, you know, if we did that, that would be the thin end of a wedge, right? It would be the one little thing that starts a deviation from the norms when everything will fall apart. Wouldn't, you know, I think if you'd write a show about the civil service today, I don't know whether phrases like that would feel at all as natural as they did in the world of Yes Minister. So do you think that we've lost that strong sense of traditions and norms for good or for ill?
I think the answer is yes and no. I think the perfect example, the current example of what happens if you lose the norms and the traditions is what Donald Trump did when he was president and what he would do if he became president again. He didn't care about the norms. He didn't care what was usually done. He didn't care about tradition. He just did what he wanted. That's why the norms are important. That's why the rules are important. That's why they should only be changed carefully. That would be Humphrey's position. Because there's no British constitution, written constitution, there is, of course, a huge unspoken constitution. Governments can take power and make changes that only they want. They don't have to make it fit with the written constitution. So, for instance, when Tony Blair changed Prime Minister's question time to only once a week, I think, when he reformed the House of Lords, now, that was a huge constitutional change. They abolished the office of Lord Chancellor, except in name, and created a Ministry of Justice. To me, the words Ministry of Justice are a kind of contradiction in terms. Justice cannot be dispensed by a government department. So I think the answer is yes, the norms are important. The norms have changed, much less so here than in America, for instance, where I live now. And that's both good and bad. And we were always very careful when we wrote this show not to take sides, not to comment. We wanted the audience to make up its own mind. And the result was, curiously, we thought everybody would hate the program in government. The civil servants loved it because it showed that they were so brilliant around the country. The politicians loved it because it showed that the civil service was an obstacle. And liberals liked it because they thought it had a vaguely liberal sort of feel. And so the strange result was the people across the political spectrum and the civil service really liked the show because in some ways it reflected what all of them thought. I don't think political drama should tell people what to think. Most political dramatists write plays with a message. We didn't have a message. We just said, this is what happens. And isn't it absurd?
So the show is so insightful about different areas of politics and about the political dynamics that are involved in making government work and making change in government. How did you go about researching those topics? How is it that you were able to understand those processes and turn them into an entertaining comedy format at a time when that reality was difficult to see for many people?
Well, we did a lot of research. We didn't just write down funny things that occurred to us. On the contrary, we had a couple of sources who... our deal with our sources was that we would never name them unless they wanted to be named. Well, a couple of them did want to be named. Marcia Faulkender, who Tony knew, Marcia Williams, who had been Harold Wilson's political secretary, was one of our sources. She was a very funny, I don't know how scrupulous, but very funny, cynical reporter of what went on in Number 10 and in government. I had a source, a man called Bernard Donoghue, who had been head of the political unit in Number 10 under both Harold Wilson and Jim Callaghan, which is very unusual. And he was full of funny insights. We were guided by those two towards other people who were experts in whatever subject we were writing about. So we had a lot of sources, mostly politicians, some civil servants. And we would work out a plot for an episode, which took us quite a long time usually, because we wanted to make sure it was balanced and the leverage between the two of them was right, and so forth. And we always had to have a plot and a subplot, or almost always, in order for there to be some deal at the end. And then we would show the script to our sources and get their comments on it. And sometimes they would say, well, that wouldn't happen. Or sometimes they would say, actually, what happened there was funnier. So by the time we finished the script, we'd had a great deal of input from people who had been in government for many years. And they were all very carefully researched. And the question we would ask them was not, has this happened, but could this happen? Because in comedy, you sometimes want things that have probably not happened, but could happen. So, for instance, when we wrote an episode about the National Health Service.
An empty hospital, right? The minister goes on a ministerial visit, and this hospital that's won, I believe, a Florence Nightingale Award for hygiene or cleanliness turns out not to have any patients at all. Sorry to jump in.
But a full administrative staff of administrators, doctors, nurses, everybody, but no patients. Well, we invented that as a sort of the height of absurdity. And then we discovered that there were, in fact, six such hospitals in the UK, including one in Cambridgeshire, I think, which had one patient who was matron, that was the head of nursing, who had tripped over the builder's scaffolding and had been hospitalised.
And you incorporated that into a line in the show, I believe.
I can't remember. Maybe we did. But the point is that we researched it in such a way that anything that occurred in the show was possible, and in many cases had happened. And I think that was its strength. We didn't invent very much. We invented a lot of very funny dialogue and some good situations. But, I mean, for instance, when Sir Humphrey is accused by Jim of being the fifth man in the Burgess, MacLean, Philby, Anthony Blunt spy ring, that could easily happen. In fact, the head of the civil service at that time, there were rumours that he had been a Russian spy. So, you know, we tried to link it to reality as much as we could by researching it carefully.
Let's take a moment to talk about one fan of the show. And as you're pointing out, there's many fans of the show across a broad political spectrum. But famously, Margaret Thatcher said that it was her favourite television programme. And there's something ironic about that, because as we're talking about, it is a show that takes these norms very seriously, whose protagonist, Sir Humphrey, takes these norms extremely seriously. And even though it's not a party political program in any way, one would imagine, I don't know whether you would dispute that, that Sir Humphrey would have voted for the Conservative Party. He seemed in many ways quite small-c conservative creature. And yet the reason why Margaret Thatcher loved the show was precisely because she had fights with the civil service. She felt that the civil service was insufficiently willing to implement her political program and her reforms. And so she liked the show because she thought that it actually exposed the small-c conservative norms and assumptions of civil servants like Sir Humphrey. So there's a kind of interesting irony here. What did you expect the audience to think about where the show fell? Who did you vote for in the 1979 election, if you feel comfortable sharing that? And what do you think explains Margaret Thatcher's attraction to the show?
I'm really trying to think hard about the implications of what you've just said. Mrs. Thatcher liked the show because, as you said, it showed the problems with the civil service. The civil service liked the show because it showed their problems with Mrs. Thatcher. But it wasn't about Labour or Conservative. I also got a letter from Tony Benn, who was a very left-wing member of the Labour Party, was known as the leader of the loony left, as the popular press called it, who wrote to me and said he'd stop talking about the civil service because we did it so much better. So it was politicians across the board. And we took the view that although there is a political party called officially Her Majesty's Opposition, which at the moment is the Labour Party, but it could be either party, the real opposition, they're just the government in exile. At the moment, the Labour Party is the government in exile. The opposition is the civil service. So that's why it appealed to politicians of all parties, I think. How did I vote? Well, I would have voted Labour, although I might not have done in 1979 because Jim Callaghan's government was in such a mess and there was such confusion. I can't remember who I voted for in 1979. By the middle of Thatcher's regime, I was certainly voting Labour, but pretty reluctantly because they were chaotic as well. But Tony really admired and loved the Thatcher government, Tony, my co-writer. He was very conservative. I leaned left, he leaned right. He helped Nigel Lawson, the Chancellor, Norman Tebbit, and ultimately Mrs. Thatcher with their speeches, with budget speeches, and with Mrs. Thatcher's election programs. I was anxious that this didn't come out, and mostly it didn't, because I didn't want people to think it was a conservative program. I wouldn't have dreamt of helping any of those politicians with what they wanted to say. So the result was the show was very well balanced because Tony and I, in a way that doesn't happen quite so often today, he was very right-wing, I was not. Today, that tends to mean that people don't get along with each other. Then there are cross-party friendships that don't really exist the way they used to. Tony and I were very good friends. We implicitly gave each other a veto. So if he wrote something that I thought was really wrong, we either added something else which boosted the other point of view, or we cut the line in question if I found it offensive. And I gave him the right of veto the same way. So the programme, I think, was balanced partly by the fact that Tony and I had completely differing political points of view. But we both found the same things funny.
That's the important thing. That helps to explain the feel of the show, actually, in an interesting way to me. I wasn't quite, I had a sense of that, but I wasn't quite fully aware of that. To keep going on the theme of what may have changed, I've been reflecting on some attempts to create new political sitcoms in the United Kingdom or the United States. And perhaps the most successful writer of political sitcoms for the last 20 or so years has been Armando Iannucci, whose work I also appreciate and admire, though it's never going to be quite as formative to me as Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister was. And I'm trying to reflect on how the shows that he has created are similar or different than Yes Minister. And I want to start with The Thick of It, which is a British political sitcom. It was sort of partially incorporated into a movie that some American listeners to the show may have watched called In the Loop, which is really all about the run-up to the Iraq War, but shared some of its cinematographic universe with The Thick of It, which is this pre-existing sitcom about Whitehall, about British politics. Now, some of the things are similar in that show, but it strikes me that there's also some real differences. One difference is visual, right? You go from the kind of old-fashioned, wood-paneled interiors with sort of armchairs that I associate with Yes Minister to the kind of modern hot desk office feel that is much more typical of a modern corporate environment in The Thick of It. But there's also, I think, a sense of, it's a different sensibility, it's a different thesis about how government works, right? If Yes Minister is quite competent people, certainly extremely competent people in the civil service, knowing exactly how things are supposed to be done and impeding in certain ways the will of the elected politicians when it clashes with those. To me, The Thick of It, as well as In the Loop and in the more American incarnation of it, Veep, which is also created by Armando Iannucci, has a very different thesis. It is people who are not very competent, who might be smart, who might be energetic, but who are con- continually discombobulated by new turns of events, whose plans never work out as they want them, whose catchphrase is not something like, this is the thin end of a wedge, but the phrase, the omni-shambles, right? When everything goes wrong at the same time and government isn't able to accomplish what it wants out of a sheer inability to, you know, of man to be master over matter. To what extent do you think shows like The Thick of It or In the Loop, or if you want, Veep, reflect a genuine change in the times? To what extent does that suggest that the world is no longer that which it was when you wrote Yes Minister? And to what extent do you think this is just a different creator's different sensibility in what they perceive about the political world?
I would say it's the third of those. It's a different viewpoint. The politicians are not competent in The Thick of It, but Jim is not really very competent either, Jim in Yes Minister. I think it's just a different view. It takes a different vantage point. It's much more about PR. Peter Capaldi's character, which was based on Alistair Campbell, I think, was very, very funny.
So Peter Capaldi is the director of communications in The Thick of It, and he's based on Alistair Campbell, who was the director of communications in Tony Blair's government.
That's right. And this was sort of about Tony Blair's government in The Thick of It. And the jokes were a very different sort. I mean, Peter Capaldi was funny just because he spoke in this constant stream of obscenities, which was a very funny idea. But I'm not sure that that was necessarily reflective of anything other than that character. Veep, I think, was a really good show. I mean, I think The Thick of It was too, but it just took... It wasn't really analysing the system. We were the foundation of Amando Inouye's shows, which he's often said, because we analysed how the system worked. People didn't know that before. Then his jokes are all based on that. And, you know, I mean, Tony Blair is an interesting example because he started off pretty competently. He was really a great PR man, a great image for the Labour Party. I suspect Gordon Brown did most of the fundamental thinking, certainly the financial part of it. And then Blair absolutely blew it by joining in the Iraq War. I think the war was a terrible mistake, and I think that all the troubles that we've seen in the Middle East for the last 20 years stem from that calamitous decision to go to war against Iraq when Iraq had had nothing to do with the bombing of the Twin Towers. And at that point, Blair lost his political touch. He lost his need and his ability, his extraordinary ability, to stay in touch with the mood of the British people. Veep takes it a step further, I think, but the vice president really, she has really very little clue about norms, about morality, about anything other than just trying to win. And she's entirely about public relations. So I think that what Amando did was he wrote about much more about the public relations aspect of government, which is huge, than about any systems, which is what we were doing.
I mean, could you say that the two shows are motivated by different formative experiences? I mean, you started to write in the last years of the Labour government before Margaret Thatcher, and it was a time in which Britain was stuck in stasis, in dysfunction, which had been particularly clear in that last Labour government, but also in the previous Conservative government. There was a sense of immobility, a sense of the norms and traditions being very strong, but nevertheless, the country falling apart. And so the animating concern was this question of continuity and change, right? Whereas Amando Iannucci wrote his first political show, and I'm going to say what you, I think, implied a little bit more starkly. I think Veep is a much better show than The Thick of It. But he wrote that coming out of the experience of Tony Blair winning a big victory in 1997, the sense that there was a very, very disciplined messaging machine, but Alistair Campbell, who's much more charming and winning and warm in person than Capaldi, his cinematographic alter ego, ever was, imposing this message discipline on the leading members of the Labour Party. You know, the famous lines that, you know, everything is about the one-liner that is going to be delivered on the news. I think Tony Blair is meant to have said, I forget whether he in fact has said this or not, a line that sounds like it could be from one of those sitcoms, which is, this is no time for sound bites, for I can feel the hand of history on my shoulder. So the idea that politics was all about sound bites. And then sort of as Iannucci's career goes on, those politicians come to be less and less competent. I guess they're already quite incompetent in the thick of it, but certainly by the time we get to the wonderful character that Julia Louis-Dreyfus plays in Veep, we're really in the heart of that kind of incompetence. So, you know, but that seems to also reflect a larger shift in assumptions that the public has about politics, where perhaps in the 70s and 80s they thought, well, you know, people in charge of our politics aren't very interested now in us. They don't listen to us very much. They're probably quite brilliant, but they're kind of stuck in these old ways. And today people feel that politicians are all, you know, incompetent and venal and pretty self-interested. And the span of that goes from the House of Cards, where they're self-interested and venal and Machiavellian and brilliant, to Veep, where they're self-interested and venal and, you know, complete idiots. But there's a kind of disenchantment with the ability of a system to actually deliver to people, which to me seems to be expressed in the contrast between the world of yes minister and yes prime minister on the one side and the world of Armando Iannucci in The Loop and in Veep, or even of something like House of Cards.
Well, I think you analyze it very accurately. I don't think he was interested in the system. I think he was interested in what the public criticizing, very funnily, what the public sees and thinks about politicians and about political parties. We weren't really writing that. Of course, that was an element of what we were writing, but we were writing not about party politics in any way, and not really about winning elections. I mean, of course, there were jokes about it. Jim Hacker had this thing about it was, if you said something courageous, it meant you were putting the election in doubt.
I think I'm going to try and quote part of your show to you. I think Sir Humphrey, when he tries to stop the elected politician from doing something, he says, oh, that's very courageous, minister, right? And Jim Hacker sounded like, courageous? Oh my God, let's not do that. I'm butchering the line, but that is roughly the idea, right?
Yes, that's right. But I agree with you. And I think Armando Iannucci's shows reflect the 90s and then the 21st century. And Yes Minister reflects how it was in the 1980s. My contention, and I think the public believes, that on the whole, things haven't changed as much as you would think. That, in other words, Armando focused on one aspect of government, and we focused, I think, on the whole system. But I really don't know. I have no real opinions about this. I'm not a critic. And I think he writes very, very funny shows.
So you're a Brit, but you have lived now for a good amount of time in the United States. You know, I've tried to tease out the question about temporal change, whether the world of today is the same as the world of Yes Minister. I'm going to pose you a geographic question now, which is to say, to what extent do the same dynamics obtain in the United States? Now, it feels to me that particularly when you get into particular subjects, right, the incentives that governments face in trying to regulate smoking or in making sure that the health system works well or in dealing in diplomacy with other countries are very similar. And if I say that I would love to teach a lecture course on politics one day with Yes Minister front and center, it's because as you're going through these different subject areas, there's so much humor and analytic insight and depth in Yes Minister that you could really get to some of the core dilemmas of each of these subject areas very well. And I think that, roughly speaking, would apply across democratic systems and perhaps even beyond democratic systems in some important ways. But there is also differences. And one of the differences is that the relative power and brilliance and size of the civil service does seem to loom larger in Britain in the 1980s, but also today, than it does in other countries. You know, one obvious difference, for example, is that in the British system, I believe a new minister gets to appoint basically two people. They get to appoint one SPAD special advisor who advises them on policy and one special advisor who advises them on the press work. And that is effectively it. Other than that, it is the civil servants who are running the show. In the United States, of course, an incoming presidential administration gets to appoint, I believe, around 3,000, I may be getting the number slightly wrong, political appointees. So it's not just, you know, 30 people who come in. It is a huge swath at the upper echelons of the administrative state that are political appointees put in there to implement the, you know, the political program of a new president. So does that make for a fundamental difference in the United States? Does that mean that the world of his minister is less applicable, and perhaps even the 1980s was less applicable in the United States? Or do you think that the fundamental dynamics remain similar?
I don't think it was entirely applicable for the reasons you suggest. I mean, in the State Department, I think it's about six levels down from the Secretary of State before you get to permanent officials. In the Foreign Office, that would be unthinkable. It's all about the permanent officials. It's hard to know what the ultimate difference is because both countries make huge political errors in terms of foreign affairs. But the system is different. We were asked several times to adapt Yes Minister for American television, and we really couldn't find a way to do it. There wasn't a person who was the equivalent of Sir Humphrey. I think the systems are completely different. The checks and balances system theory, which is Trump has, I must say, destroyed in the last 4 years, but it used to be about checks and balances in different parts of the administration. Britain doesn't really have checks and balances. It has the opposition, which at the moment is Labour, which will have fewer members in the House. It has the House of Lords, who are able to ask awkward questions, but they don't ever really stop anything happening that the government wants. And the government has a much freer hand, actually, in Britain to do what it wants than it does in the States, especially as the States consist of 50 federated states, which all have different laws anyway about many things. Obvious examples would be guns, immigration, and numerous other subjects. I don't think the two countries are very comparable politically. I think they work very differently.
I agree with you that there is no Sir Humphrey in the American system. And of course, there's no imaginary in America of the role of a civil service. I mean, there are, in fact, I believe, about a million federal employees in the United States, many of whom do incredibly valuable and important work. But in part because you didn't make the American version of Yes Minister, it's very hard for most Americans to imagine what they do. And of course, one of the reasons you didn't make the show is that none of them quite have the kind of role and the kind of prestige that a Sir Humphrey, that a permanent secretary of a big Whitehall department does in the United Kingdom. If I were to locate one similarity, though, it may be in a new set of cultural self-understandings of a contemporary American elite. And I wonder what you make of that argument. So, you know, I don't think that anybody today has the self-understanding, the self-perception that Sir Humphrey had in the 1980s. You know, based in self-consciously in being the establishment, in being the sound person who stands up for the things that have always been done, because everything else would be a kind of betrayal.
Well, that's right, because Yes Minister changed that. Politicians decided they really didn't want that. They hadn't quite grasped it themselves. And they decided they wanted it to be different.
But where I wonder whether there may be some parallel similarity is in the world that you and I are both in the United States, right? A world of highly educated people in metropolitan centers who I think do also have a sense of, we know how things should be done. We are the enlightened elite of this country. And, you know, we are in a sense being assailed by the great unwashed masses who don't understand this, who are challenging what this country should actually be. Now, you might say that perhaps today those fears about people like Donald Trump are better grounded. And of course, this fear in the figure of somebody like Sir Humphrey came from a small C conservative. Today, perhaps that fear is mostly located among people who think of themselves as being pretty progressive. But I wonder if you see any parallel at all between sort of Sir Humphrey's self-understanding as a defender of a certain set of ideas that are under attack from the broader public, and the way that many members of our social and cultural milieu might think of their role in the United States today.
Well, yes, but in America, it's completely, almost completely, about partisan politics. Democrats are flatly opposed to Donald Trump's attacks on democracy and his obvious wish to be a dictator. And the Republicans have somehow allowed themselves to be trampled by Trump into agreeing with his views. As for the public, it's curiously enough, in America, it's the people we would call the working class who are supporting Trump, although everything he wants is against their interests. I feel like in America we're living in the Weimar Republic, and I just hope it ends differently from the way the Weimar Republic ended.
How would you go about making a political comedy about the United States in 2024? Or do you think that sort of the anger in the system is too intense and the stakes are too high to effectively make a political comedy at this juncture? What advice would you give to a 30-year-old who wants to do that today?
I would say it's really high risk, because if you're going to make a comedy, I mean, the comedy about Donald Trump is so obvious. I mean, I think Veep did the best job that was possible in terms of a comedy show about American politics or American government. I don't think there's much more to be said. I think the people who would appreciate the show already know everything there is to know about it. And the people who wouldn't appreciate the show would just be full of hatred. There are people like Liz Cheney and Mitt Romney and the Lincoln Project who actually have an understanding of what Trump wants to do to democracy. But they're now a very tiny proportion of the Republican Party. It's very broad brush satire that you would use, and the people do, about Donald Trump. And you could write something subtler about the Democratic politicians. But I didn't write about politics. That's what I keep saying. I wrote about government. And although politics is a part of government, what Tony and I were interested in was how the system worked or didn't work. And here the system has essentially broken down in America. There's now a huge division. And there's no common agreement about norms, rules, how to behave, how not to behave, how you should do things, how you shouldn't do things. That's gone. For the moment, it may come back. I hope it does, but it's gone.
Jonathan Lin, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening to The Good Fight. Lots of listeners have been spreading the word about this show. If you too have been enjoying the podcast, please be like them, rate the show on iTunes, tell your friends all about it, share it on Facebook or Twitter. And finally, please mail suggestions for great guests or comments about the show to goodfightpod goodfightpod@gmail.com. That's goodfightpod@gmail.com.
This recording carries a Creative Commons 4.0 international license. Thanks to Silent Partner for their song, Chess Pieces.